The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
Well, 1 year ago, the pandemic struck. It also coincided with the launch of our show, The Pulse on CFRO, a daily news show focused on the downtown east side. And every Thursday, we're looking back on our original week of guests at the start of the pandemic and our show to find out what they've learned over 1 year of a pandemic and its impact in the downtown east side. Today's guest is Fiona York. She was the third guest on our program last March and is with the Carnegie Community Action Project. Thanks so much, Fiona, for coming back on The Pulse here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a wild year. We're looking back over 1 year since COVID came into our lives. I'm wondering, first of all, just to start off, you know, for you, how has this year changed the way that you organize and work?
Well, I think when COVID started, things really doubled up immensely in terms of the work we're doing. There was a lot, obviously, there's always a lot and there's a lot going on beforehand. And then with COVID, it just really kind of changed the scope of the work and the amount of the work and the capacity for the work. It became more almost like round the clock, but also kind of reminded us, like came for full circle back in a way and reminded us of the other things that are going on, because we always come back to the fact that we have a pandemic, but we've also already had a pandemic on our hands. We already have crises that we're dealing with. And so it just reminds us and reinforces those other things that we're working on.
Has it been difficult to sort of keep up the momentum as well in terms of people's own capacities? I know that, you know, being able to organize takes energy, takes persistence, takes, you know, 24/7, as you said.
Yeah, it feels like it's kind of been like that, and it still continues to be. And yeah, certainly it's a capacity issue. I think, though, we've also seen the emergence of a lot of community care and a lot of community support in different areas. So, even though definitely on the front lines and with organizing work, it's redoubled, as I said, but, I'm always like really touched and impressed by how much support there is. Like, there's obviously a lot of negative stuff too, and negative sort of feedback and backlash that happens, but there's also, you know, really strong core of community support that really comes through. So I'm always like really amazed by how much support we get. And so that obviously, helps the capacity, helps with sort of like the burnout and just kind of shows that there is that positive support, as well as all the kind of, you know, the stigmatizing and stereotypes that helped to cause some of these problems in the first place.
Did you know that you were the third ever guest on this program, The Pulse?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, you were on the third day, so the Wednesday. We launched on March 23rd, and you know, if you can think back to that, you know, middle of March time period as this pandemic became declared such. What was the situation like on the ground in terms of homelessness, in terms of Tent City, in terms of what you were working on then? Do you remember?
So, yes, in March, I guess, so we were working with the Tent City in Oppenheimer Park. And then I remember in March just being like panic stricken with COVID starting. And then the kind of dramatizing situation in Oppenheimer where, because of all the shutdowns, the community shutdowns, and like how things changed so rapidly in terms of access to spaces and access to services in the downtown east side. And so there was sort of this dissension on Oppenheimer Park where so many people were going there. Like, you could instantly see that there are more people on the street, there's more homelessness, less services, less access to food and other resources for people. And this increase of people coming to Oppenheimer Park, because that was where there was like a little bit of access, but even still there was like no washrooms, there was barely running water. So it was really, really difficult and really just very difficult and tense. And then the impending threat or the impending like fear of COVID on top of everything else. So all of that kind of happening at once, I guess that's where we were at in March, was that there was this increase in the population at Oppenheimer Park, the lack of services. It made everything much harder to access for people. There was so little that was available because the shutdown was so rapid.
Can you talk about that? Like, what closed down exactly in the neighborhood?
Well, I remember almost like within the first week, so I think March 17th was when things started to shut down, and then almost like just days later, walking around Main and Hastings, and the Carnegie Center was closed, and that was just so shocking to see the Carnegie Center shut down. And because the Carnegie Center itself, just like that one place, has hundreds of people every day who are in there accessing services, but also just like being inside, like having a place to be inside in the library, in the lounge, or in the theater, or in like different programs, and then looking on the street, and I could just see that there were more people on the street than ever before. And, you know, knowing that there's all these dire warnings about not being close together, and the hand washing, and social distancing, and all of those things, and so little information that was being shared. So with places like the Carnegie and the library shutting down, and then so many like coffee shops and restaurants, and then people who relied on Wi-Fi access or information or posters or information through those places were not getting information, but people kind of knew about COVID or a little bit and knew that it was something important and serious, but didn't really have that access to information. And then just like all the day-to-day things like lunches and meals and the library and a place to sit down, a place to wash your hands, washrooms, all of that, it just seemed very sudden and very noticeable, and felt almost like this apocalyptic feeling where everywhere you turn, things were closed that you're used to having open, and there's nowhere for people to be. And so people were just on the street or in Oppenheimer Park.
You mentioned, you know, sinks and washrooms. I know showers closed down as well. You know, these basic sanitation things.
Yeah, that was the one. I think that was sort of like the immediate thing that dawned on everybody, was that directive to like isolate at home, to stay at home, to wash your hands, and then not having all of those things. And that was one of the first sort of slow things that started to be provided. So having the hand washing stations, a few porta potties, but it didn't really make up for the fact that there was a closure and the loss of all those indoor services. So just having a few hand washing places on the street might have been helpful if all the indoor places were also open and they were in addition, but to replace all those indoor services was not really, not really helping build capacity or more access in those areas. So it still felt really like people were quite abandoned when everybody else got to just like go home and work from home be shelter at home and have that that sort of wraparound support by being in your own home and having services, but people who just felt abandoned.
Could you talk a bit about what happened in the SROs as well? Because I understand in SROs and supportive housing, a lot just immediately put down a blanket, no guest policy. Did that contribute to the rise of people at Oppenheimer, do you think, and on the streets?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I definitely knew and spoke to people. There's one woman who had been staying at a friend's house, and she was doing his housekeeping. So she was staying at her friend with her adult son, and almost immediately they were evicted and they came to Oppenheimer Park. And they just kind of showed up one day, and it was a mother and son and needed to be sheltered. And there was also a young woman who used to stay at her partner's place, and then she wasn't allowed to go in, and she was sleeping on the street in front of her partner's building every night, and then eventually came to Oppenheimer Park. So those were the kind of stories that I heard, and it was obvious, like you could see the increase in the numbers. And later, the kind of official estimate from the city of Vancouver, when they're talking about numbers for the mayor's emergency motion for Strathcona Park back in last October, normally they talk about 600 unsheltered people with the numbers from the homelessness count, but they increase it to 750, which is still pretty conservative. But it was actually like that was an acknowledgement from the city itself that there was this 25 or 30% increase in unsheltered homelessness. Not mention the sheltered homelessness. Another thing that happened was that shelters were ordered to reduce their capacity. So a shelter like, I think, First United or other shelters were actually told to reduce the number of guests or people that they sheltered. And so, again, it was just like this immediate increase of people on the street who don't have the shelter. And then, if, you know, at the same time, as you said, those directives to shelter in place and to you know, access sanitation and all of those things that are just impossible in those situations.
So let's go back to Oppenheimer Park. In the midst of all this, the park had grown significantly in numbers of tents and number of residents. It also attracted a fair bit of attention from government and authorities over the course of April and May.
So it increased from the August of 2019, it was up about 300. And that was when there was the big housing push and the freeze on SRO units, and people, a lot of people were housed, but the calculation was wrong. So there's still a lot of people unhoused, and then the tent city grew again. And through the winter, of course, was a little bit less, but in like January, February, it's probably like 100, 150, but it swelled pretty quickly to about 300 again around March and April because of those reasons that I was describing. And then, yeah, definitely did garner the attention of the various levels of government, and then there's this sort of big organized strategy through the Ministry of Poverty Reduction and Social Development that was kind of put forward by Shane Simpson, the Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, with the and it was kind of unusual because it was not an injunction order for Oppenheimer Park. It was a safety order, a provincial safety order, which, you know, it, because it's on the provincial level, it's very hard to actually address or to counter. It was also kind of unusual in that it came with this offer of the hotels, which is something that we on the ground were calling for across the board, for everyone, for people living in SROs, for people who are homeless, for people in tent cities, for everyone. But it was, again, targeted and directed to people in Oppenheimer Park. So it was a very kind of cynical move to, under the guise of COVID and safety, rather than offering those access to those places to everyone who needed it. And I would have suggested everyone who is most at risk. So looking at people in shelters or people in SROs who are meet the high risk factors, like seniors and people with like the especially compromised health and the most vulnerable and most susceptible to COVID, it should have been the strategy, but instead it was directed to people staying in Oppenheimer Park very specifically, and so that the park could be closed, because that was something that was desired already. And so it was kind of this motive to address COVID by targeting Oppenheimer Park rather than offering those hotel rooms to keep people safe and to let people shelter in place to the people who most needed it, and also to have far more available so that everyone who needed it could access that.
Now, some people, you know, said that they didn't feel comfortable going to some of the shelters offered. I know that's been a continued thing that's been repeated at the new Strathcona Park. Can you talk a bit about what people sort of told you around that? Why are some people uncomfortable going to the shelters or hotels offered?
It seems like this is sort of the cyclical strategy that is just offered over and over again by the various levels of government. And they sort of package it in different ways, or like do it in a way that appears more compassionate. But it's basically the same thing where a tent city is being targeted for housing for the sake of clearing it for reasons that generally have more to do with like neighboring businesses or other outside forces or concerns than people who are staying in the park, because they're offering housing or so-called housing or shelter that's not really meeting the needs that people have. So it's a strategy of like freezing or holding or offering SRO rooms that are have so many issues with them. We had a gentleman here from Strathcona Park who was housed in an SRO, and he stayed there for about 1.5 nights and then refused to go back and came back to the tent city, and for like the last couple of months has been staying here in the tent city because it was just not a habitable place for him because of the habitability, the maintenance of the place, and that it was so noisy for him. It has bugs, the washrooms and all the shared spaces are not in good condition. And of course, it also is a shared space. So the shared washroom and shared common spaces, which is not something that, you know, is directed by COVID. So it was just not a suitable place for him. And that seems to be sort of the course for many of the people being housed from Strathcona Park.
When a lot of people, you know, sleep on people's floors when they are short of housing, as you have no guests allowed, Like, you can't do that, nor can you use drugs with a buddy as is required and recommended.
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, I know strategies where people are in this isolation, and my close friend's son passed away in an SRO, and she was not able to see him. She had been calling for days and wasn't able to reach him or to visit him. And, you know, this is the kind of tragedy that can happen with not having access to guests. Or, you know, family and friends, you know, it's very isolating and can be very tragic.
I'm sorry to hear about your friend's son. That's tragic.
And the other type of housing or the other type of accommodation sounds like it will be offered as part of this mix for Strathcona Park is a 60-bed shelter. And I know that everyone I've spoken to here in the park is not interested in staying in a shelter. You know, they've had many experiences of being in shelters. It doesn't work for them. It really, you know, it's somewhere where people usually have to leave in the morning. They can't have all their belongings necessarily. They end up still being displaced every day. And it's just not really a place that's conducive when somebody, you know, is looking for actual housing or a place to, like, put their stuff, and a place that they can be with some sense of security or regularity. They're not interested in staying in a shelter. And also, again, all the, you know, visitation rules and all the restrictions and rules go with that. It's not something that's really conducive for people who are just looking for independent housing. So we're just seeing this kind of rollout of a package of accommodations that is not really addressing what people's housing needs are. And it's just a lot of the sort of same old that's been offered before in these situations, not really learning from that necessarily. I think one thing I'm hearing from the park board and the city that maybe is a little bit different is that they seem to have an understanding that they shouldn't just be offering any new housing to people in the park and that they want to be equitable about it. But I sort of yet to actually see any numbers around that or about how that's being offered. So, you know, I don't know how accurate that is. But, you know, obviously there should just be housing for the whole 2,200 people or 2,300 people that are homeless.
Now, to this day, about 10 months later, Oppenheimer Park remains surrounded by a spiked-topped blue chain fence and has become inaccessible to the neighborhood. And the tent city that was there migrated down to Crab Park. You've spent, and others, much of the last year, or last half of the year, dealing with the court injunction and the charges that came from that. Do you have any reflections on that?
Just a real waste of resources and time. And I guess the difference in those situations. So Oppenheimer Park, like under the jurisdiction of the park board, who initially were fairly compassionate in their approach, but in the end, it has rendered this park completely inaccessible. And kind of, I feel like they sort of doubled down on efforts to prevent tent cities in the future, which really calls into question the whole issue of public space and people being able to be in public spaces, because we know there's not enough housing. We know that people are on the street or homeless, and where are they going to be able to go when, you know, now we see parks actually being fenced off and nobody can access them. And then Crab Park, the parking lot is fenced off, and now there's the beginning of a fence with Strathcona Park. So it's this limitation of public space, both for the general public, but also for people who simply don't have space that they can legally be in, because people can't be on the street. There's street sweeps. They can't be, you know, all these services where they can't like go and sleep during the day in a library. They can't be in a park now with the new park bylaw and like fences around parks. So it just results in like less and less places where people can be. And we're not seeing a similar uptake in new housing where people.
One of the things that's come up again and again, a lot of homeowners' concerns about, you know, crime or violence in the neighborhood. We've seen a couple incidents where the police came in and arrested someone, you know, in a horrific crime in the West Side. What do you say when you see these kind of concerns coming up again and again?
I guess, I mean, it's not to say that there hasn't been. There, you know, recently the death of the senior, you know, that's obviously a tragic and horrific thing, and it's really awful that it happened. But we also know, and I see over and over, that there is like a really different treatment of things that happen in and around or connected in any way to the tent city or to the park than when it happens anywhere else. I can point to any number of similar situations that have happened in SROs. There was a fire recently in an SRO where 10 people were displaced. There was a couple of stabbings in another one. There was there's one SRO that had 2 murders in less than 1 year. There is another one where, I mean, just horrific things that happen in so many places and so many locations. It could be in the West End. It could be in Surrey. It could be in on Granville Street. It could be in any of those locations. But you never see the level of fear mongering and stigma and anxiety and media attention that you do when it is any kind of connection to the tent city. So it's just a really, really different treatment. And, there's a lot of media coverage. There's a lot of very high visibility, high level of anxiety. It's just a different type of media coverage that you see many of those other incidents. I know about them, but I don't see them covered in any media. They're barely reported on. So, of course, that negative reporting is just reinforcing over and over that a place is dangerous or that bad things happen in a certain place. Whereas if you look at actual crime statistics, it's just really sort of blown out of proportion.
Is there one thing in the last year of COVID that from you working in solidarity with the tent cities has taught you just about community or about the people you've met there?
I guess I'd come back to the community care because it really grew, like starting with Oppenheimer when we were sort of organizing food and donations. There was like a real growth I felt of people who, you know, rightly or wrongly because of COVID, it kind of shed that additional light on the vulnerability of people in the downtown east side and people who are homeless, and maybe just gave people something to kind of organize around. And I think that kind of grew from there. So even with all the negativity, which of course has grown as well over the last year, and all the things that have to push back on and to fight against, but also seeing that level of community support, again, I always find it really amazing that we've had this level, like being able to provide the infrastructure and the supports that we've been able to provide, largely through community support. And so there's lots of negative attention, but I think there's also some, like, lots of positives for sure within the community and some awareness within certain communities anyway, and a lot of compassion that I've seen over the last year. So I don't know if it's, like, totally attributed to COVID, but I think it did sort of help to direct some attention and some light onto people who are vulnerable and show the level of community care that there is.
Thank you so much for your time, Fiona. It's great to talk to you, and I wish you the best of health.
Thank you very much.
Take good care. Bye-bye. And that was Fiona York, an organizer with the Carnegie Community Action Project. Stay tuned next Thursday for the next in our series, looking back over 1 year of the Pulse and 1 year of the pandemic in the downtown east side.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.